Welcome back. This is the Coaches Rising podcast, and I'm delighted to be joined again today by Jeremy Johnson, who I've learned a lot from. I really recommend his book, Seeing Through the World. And we're going to be exploring today how integral futuring can help us navigate the temporal complexity of the polycrisis, of the metacrisis, and restore a living relationship to our future. So some of the topics we're going to unpack today: the temporal nature of this metacrisis we find ourselves in, how we can restore our relationship to the future and tend to latent futures. And we'll talk about the practice of weaving time, amongst many other things. So Jeremy is an author, as I mentioned. He wrote Seeing Through the World, which is a great book. He is the managing editor of Integral Leadership Review, a podcaster. His Mutations podcast is excellent. And he currently serves as the president for the International Gene Gebser Society. So with all that being said, let's dive in. Here's the podcast with Jeremy Johnson. I don't have to tell you that these are turbulent times. They're astonishing times. Many people are feeling deeply challenged, more reactive, and my sense is in more need of coaching than ever. And while these times are full of challenges, they're also ripe with evolutionary potential. This is the gift of these times. And I think it's these moments that coaches are built for, so we can help our clients unlock the deeper capacities and intelligence that's required of them now. And that's exactly what our newest program, Unlocking Leaders, is all about. You'll learn how to work at the source code of change, beyond strategy, beyond protocol, at the level of consciousness itself. This, for me, has been by far the biggest leverage I have with my clients. It's the most potent move I can make, because the level of consciousness a leader is operating from determines everything. What they notice, what they miss, whether they react defensively, stay grounded, whether they tighten in control or open into creativity and collaborativity, and ultimately what becomes possible in how they lead. And when you work at this level, you'll be able to tap into these hidden drivers behind decisions and behaviors and unlock possibilities in situations that once felt stuck. And beyond that, importantly, you're going to cultivate a capacity that AI will never possess. As AI expands and begins to dominate procedural and operational coaching, as it grows, it's becoming clearer what it cannot do. And it can't feel, it can't connect in the same way when two human beings come together and the field that they create becomes part of the transformational conversation. It can't work with consciousness, the very source of transformation and the source of the most powerful coaching moves. This is what separates good coaches from great coaches working at this level. And AI can't touch this. So if you're interested to find out more about this program, if you feel called to join us, then head to coachesrising.com/leaders to book your spot. The first class is June 16th with Jim Dethmer, just an incredible, masterful coach. And he's joined by Bob Anderson, also a true pioneer in the field of conscious leadership and coaching. And if you sign up by May 29th, you can get the early bird discount. Enrollment is open until June 12th. So head to coachesrising.com/leaders to book your spot. Jeremy, it's delightful to be with you again. I've been really anticipating this conversation. I've really appreciated coming across your work. And so I'm excited to share again, like how your thinking and your practice has kind of unfolded since we last spoke. I don't know when that was, actually 4 years ago, wasn't it?
Anyway. Yeah, something like that. 3 years, maybe three and a half. I've been in my own kind of weird time dilation. We were just talking about it, becoming a parent and moving and living in the mountains of Vermont. So I feel like I'm in a different timeline myself. So 3.5 years, probably. Great to be with you, Joel. Picking right back up where we left off. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, beautiful. I thought about beginning by just inviting you to share. I really recommend people check out your recent podcast as well. It's really, really good. But to just kind of start to talk about integral futuring, and I know you have a program on that out coming out, and to talk about what that is and why it's important and the relationship, particularly why time, something you write about a lot, why that's an important element in all of this. Let's kind of paint the picture of like where we're at in this point in history, really, and what the invitation is.
Yeah, so it's integral futuring. This book that I've been working on, Fragments of an Integral Future, it's been kind of a long process. I mean, last time we spoke, I was still kind of in the thick of it, and this past year or so I've really been sort of developing the final piece of the book, which is this concept of integral futuring. And as you know, it draws a lot from the work of Jean Gebser and his work on ever-present origin. And Gebser is one of these sort of interesting, as folks may be familiar with already, maybe not, history of consciousness figures, right? He has sort of an interesting, unique emphasis on time in his thinking, on how, our contemporary crisis, we call it the polycrisis or the meta-crisis, one of the threads that ends up being a through line is our relationship with time. And for Gebser, he saw our relationship with time, or you could call it our consciousness of time, was undergoing this sort of dissolution and metamorphosis in the 20th century, in the 19th century. It's a kind of underlying theme of modernity is this wrestling with the nature of time. And Gebser's not the only thinker to speak about this. I think Bergson is another one, who Gebser borrows some of that language from, where he describes a sort of mechanical, what he calls spatialized time, the clock time, is the sort of time that's sort of becoming, I guess you could describe it as imploding under its own weight, right? It's unleashing forces into the world that it actually can't master with the same kind of thinking. There's a kind of an intensity of time that's revving up in the 20th century, and of course, becoming even more of a crisis in the 21st. So for me, time, temporality ends up being the sort of, I don't know what a good, maybe a cipher is a good word for it, right? There's a sort of endless, ciphering of our contemporary crisis with time, whether we're speaking about the climate crisis and the temporality of the climate crisis, which sort of entangles the past and the future in the present and makes the present kind of laden with a sense of both the growing maybe guilt, for folks who are like aware of the climate crisis and the sort of history of it, uses of fossil fuels. There's a drawing up of the past, right? And literally in the sense of fossil fuels being the ancient dead of Gaia, right? Ancient living beings, which have become now fuel for the machines, but then also the sense that we're affecting the future and that the future is very present and transparent, right? The future kind of, a lot of climate scientists are talking about it as climate collapse, but there's words for it now in a sort of colloquial sense, right? People call it solastalgia, this mourning the future or mourning the present that's receding, right? There's a present that's being lost in the process of being lost. And there is a kind of anticipatory mourning towards that present as it's being lost in the sense of the future, right? Whether it's extinction, et cetera. So we're already, there's a kind of climate melancholia, right? Which is a temporal feeling. It's a structure of feeling that has to do with time, both past and future. So we're dealing with time, whether we're looking at it with the climate crisis or we're looking at it more with technology and runaway forces that, the latest might be of like, artificial intelligence, just sort of the conditions of being a person moving through the modern world trying to survive, right? There's a kind of capitalist temporality in that sense where we're always expected to be producing and online and transforming anything that we're doing, like from hobbies to whatever, into something that's sort of engaging the world, right? So there's a kind of intensity of time that's not really a human-friendly time that we're dealing with. And I'm talking about negatives to kind of arrive at integral futuring, because for me, the future often shows up. This is my understanding. I draw it from like William Irwin Thompson, but very much is also in Gebser. The future often shows up the sort of latent transformation that's kind of being worked through shows up in a negative sense as a kind of unconscious force that's sort of breaking into or breaking through or showing up as negative conditions in the present. And integral featuring for me is sort of drawing up, becoming cognizant of those conditions, becoming aware of them, becoming present with them enough so that they don't necessarily have to be negative or have to be destructive. Time can be something very transformative rather than just a time crisis. You know, temporality is the nature of the climate crisis, and temporality and the sense of entanglement with past and future can perhaps become, you know, the means of our transformation and perhaps redemption in a sense. So anyway, integral futuring has to do with this, you know, becoming aware of the temporal nature of this crisis, really kind of leaning into it and asking, you know, what of this can become transformative? You know, how can we begin to work with this a bit more consciously? How can we begin to engage this in a transformative sense or a sense of cultural metamorphosis, right? And while Gebser didn't talk about integral futuring, he certainly talked about the sense that not only the past being present in these sort of social conditions and histories, but also in sort of a metaphysical sense, but the future is also present. The future shapes us, right? So there's a sense that, and it's not a single linear future, there's a sense that the future is present in a virtual way, in a kind of multiplicity. And yes, there's a lot of negative futures that are hanging heavily, you know, maybe around our necks and heavily in our hearts, but there's also the sense that, you know, once you begin to really engage with that and look at the trouble, like stay with the trouble, as Haraway says, the future can also become, you know, other futures become present. There's other possibilities that open up and disclose themselves to us. And so the last element here for integral futuring, for me anyway, is beginning to live such in the present and finding ways to be able to engage with that as a sort of personal practice, as a social practice, the threads of different, let's say, more integrative futures, more transformative futures in the present, in our social conditions. You know, they're not just negative symptoms. There are also sort of transformative elements that are in our present that we can kind of really begin to lean into and pick up on and make a part of our lives. So for me, integral futuring is living the future in the present in the sense of becoming cognizant of how climate collapse is very very present, sort of shining through time. Shreko Horvath, a Croatian philosopher, describes it as an apocalyptic X-ray, right? So there's a sense that it's mutagenic, right? It's sort of like we're aware of this sort of imminent thing that we're kind of veering towards haplessly, and it's transforming our sense of temporality. So even though it's negative, forming our relationship with the future. So if we're mutants, then let us begin to use these powers for something a bit more opening, right? Can the future become open again rather than just foreclosed in a sort of negative story of catastrophe? Hopefully that'll make sense.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Yeah, it's I really love what you're sharing, because I think, you know, I relate to this in my own life and many people I know, where, you know, I'm sure everyone listening can really relate to this sense of, you know, this shift that occurred where it used to feel like things were just going to keep getting better and better, you know, from a kind of certain worldview. But that doesn't seem the case anymore, you know, like you've just really clearly articulated. And you know, there's kind of maybe a pessimism that can come in, maybe even an apocalyptic feeling. But that is in feels very potent, because for me, it's like, well, do I just then kind of hunker down and contract and kind of get down, you know, or does it evoke some new way of being, some different kind of response inside of me? And in a sense, like, what does it invite me to examine that I have privileged in my life and valued? And what might now be being evoked inside of me, an orientation to new modes of perception? Let me just, and I'm saying a lot here, but it's like I want to contextualize this in the field of like coaching mm-hmm. work. And you know, there, we've talked a lot about this self-improvement paradigm that we are, you know, has been one of the modes in coaching. And then there's been, you know, a kind of this unfolding paradigm emerging, which is based, rooted in presence, less oriented to, you know, improving oneself into some imagined future, but actually living in the present, meeting what's here fully. And that as we do so, our experience unfolds and new life comes in. And I think that's evocative. It's kind of feels like what you're pointing to with integral futuring. So could you say a little bit more about, you know, contrasting, you know, this kind of integral, these fragments of an integral future and the different modes it's inviting us into with, you know, the kind of perspectival modern mind, which, you know, is kind of our near in lineage. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Beautifully stated. There's so much there, Joel, in what you just shared, but to kind of tackle that first. Yeah, I think you're also speaking to the kind of cultural change, the sort of bigger picture change, which I think is quite radical and maybe understated by a lot of folk aging in this work about social transformation, which is, you know, in the negative sense, maybe what we're losing and the radical change in the 20th century, folks like Bifo Berardi and Mark Fisher talk about this, and of course other thinkers talk about this as well. But the faith in the future, right? Our relationship with a perspectival future, a linear future, which has often been associated with progress or improvement, or more utopian, right? Or advancing and maturing in some way, or complexifying, right? The future always meant something more, greater. That relationship with the future is what has fundamentally changed, I think, in just the past, you know, significantly, at least in the past 20, 25 years. Our relationship with the future, our faith in that kind of future, that mythology of time and progress, is really kind of dissolved, right? And there's a lot of folks write this too, this sense of mourning the or composting modernity, right? There's sort of proclamations of the end of modernity in this sense, right? Because modernity has relied upon this interesting relationship with time, a more linear time. I like Byung-Chul Han's description of it. He calls it revolutionary time. And I think that is a useful way of talking about it, because it names the energy of it and the possibility of linear time, time as progress, which really kind of ramped up in the late 18th century, in the sense of, you know, we had the Industrial Revolution occurring right along the social revolutions that were occurring in, let's say, the United States or France, right? There was an overthrowing of the old order, of the old regime, right? And a moving into a sense of reshaping the world, right? Directing the world towards a better future. But the problem with that, many have written about and talked about, is the future as progress was claimed in exchange for the past, right? There was a rejecting of the past. And for Gebser, of course, and Bergson and other thinkers, we can't reject the past. The past is ever present. The past is alive. History has not only unfinished business, but it always has a kind of entangled relationship with the present. If we're doing more of a kind of magic mythic approach, we could say, you know, a sort of ancestral relationship in the present with us in the present, right? So the past is important. So what happens when we begin to overthrow this past? Well, the kind of temporality that modernity has relied on has pretty much remained abstract time, you know, clock time in that sense, right? And it rejects this task of integrating the past and bringing it into relationship with the new. We only want the new for the sake of the new. And that's the problem, right? Modern temporality doesn't live necessarily for the sake of the future, but as a rupture against the past and the present alike. It doesn't want to be present. It wants to get ahead. It wants to move forward. It wants to even escape time and space. There's this wonderful line from a 19th century encyclopedia where the author of this passage in the encyclopedia is talking about progress, and he associates it with what does he call it? Basically, the triumphant steam engine or triumphant engine wagon or something along those lines. And he describes it as sort of moving so quickly, moving history forward so fast that it will eventually escape space and time. There's a sort of transcendental quality to this, right? So there's this rupture against both past and present that modernity, linear time, really emphasizes. And again, because of that, because it doesn't regard a relationship between past and future, something that's actually important and vital, right? And subject to these many complex interweavings and folds and interrelationships, because it elevates absence, right? Abstraction over presence, it can't have a relationship with time in this truer sense. And this is where I borrow like Shakespeare's line of time out of joint, right? I think modern time is very much a time out of joint, a time of rupture, and therefore it's a time out of relation, right? Integral futuring then, or integral time, as maybe Gebser would describe, is a call to enter back into relationship with time and the present, and to do a much more difficult work, which is not just severing the past for the sake of the new, but to bring the new and the past into relation, right, as different elements which make up a composite, a heterogeneous composite, not a homogeneous one, a mixing and an intermix, folds and unfolds and becomes the future, right? And I think I'll talk about that a lot throughout my book and for the upcoming course on integral futuring, that when we're talking about futuring in this sense is a very different relationship with time. It's not the same kind of modern relationship with the future as progress. It's not a faith in the future, but it is a regarding of the future. It's a relation with the future, an acting for the sake of, because we're in relation with coming, with the people who are to be living, you know, in the next generations, those who will have lived. It's a much more concretizing, drawing into the present kind of relationship, a recognition that we have to be present to be in a generative relationship with the future. We can't simply be running ahead to escape the past or to sever the past. If we're not present, then we don't actually have a future, and we don't have a past either. And I think we've kind of ended up there because of, you know, again, past 200 years culminating in this crisis where the present has sort of evaporated or shrunk to this little pinpoint moment, right? This little pointless now, right? Which is not really Gebser's ever present, right? Is this sort of digital now that collapses a relationship with past and future, and asked us to be kind of in this relentless and frenetic instant moment, right? Replaced by the next and by the next and by the next. I think Mark Fisher describes it as a frenzied rush, right? But it's a frenzied rush to nowhere. There's a sense of stasis in it. I think that this is because of this fundamental relationship with time that modernity has been attempting to unleash upon the world and master. And I think it has ended up sort of backfiring in all those ways. To come back around and just wrap up, right? A relationship with the past and the future has more to do with this integral futuring, a relational time, which helps us tend to the wounds of history and opens up the future again. Sorry, Joel, that was a lot, but
yeah,
that's the kind of core nugget of what I'm working with in the book. Yeah.
Yeah. Nice. As I hear you speak about it, you know, as you contrast the two, it's like the rupture from time, or this this pinpoint of time, this sense of disconnection from the present moment and from our past and our future. It's like I get a sense of and the abstraction, you know, the abstraction from the present moment. I get a sense of how that can limit our perception. It can limit our connectedness, our interconnectedness, our ability to collaborate, to create what we perceive, what we value. And I'm just wondering for you, What do you think becomes possible when we shift out of that into this place where that bring where we bring the past and the present into a composite in the in presence? What do you think comes online when we start to do that?
Excellent question. In some ways, I have more hesitation about what that is in terms of content. The way I ended the manuscript was to at least kind of give some examples that I sense and are a part of that future or a part of that possible future. But one of the lines that I really love from the Zapatista is their vision for a planetary future, a planetary community, and they describe it as a world in which many worlds fit. There's a sense of pluralism there, but there's also a sense of the whole. But I think, part of our work right now in sort of tending to these latent futures in the present is maybe poetically summarized by Anna Singh's maybe infamous or famous line of a making a life in the ruins, and this poetic description of what we're doing here. With integral futuring, there's an element where we're both taking in the future as the ending of a certain way of thinking, a certain worldview, and working with what that worldview leaves behind, right? The fragments of modernity that are running rampant today, but also the possibilities that those fragments hold, debris and ruins, right, for new life, right, to rework the elements that are in the present, the elements that are kind of showing up amidst catastrophe, and rework them in such a way that they find new life, they find new possibilities by bringing things into different relationship. I think that's really the work, the new relationship with time and the future has a kind of, I'm borrowing a literary genre from here. We have read about it in the chapters I sent you, but salvage punk is the term, and it sort of comes after, I think it came out before solar punk, and it's sort of after cyberpunk and whatever. There's elements of both in salvage punk, but I really like the term because it's very ecological, right? It's really being with contents of the present, right? The elements and agencies, the fragments, the rubble and the ruin of modernity, and saying like, okay, well, even here, there's life. Life and agencies are seeking connection and seeking relation. So, for the integral futurist, perhaps we could call them, I think their function is very much like, if we take it from biology, the construction, right? They're a constructor or steward of ecological niches, right? Niche construction going on, where the role is really to bring things into new relation, bring different elements into new relation with each other in such a way that those relationships become, the mending of the wounds of modernity, or the possibility for different modernities to flourish, different, ways of approaching science, and perhaps some, in a way that's sort of more local based or more planetary or more animist, what hybridizations we can imagine. That's the work we need to be tending to now. We have to be like niche constructors, or moving from the ecological maybe to the more cultural, right? The artist, who's always kind of bringing things into novel relation and recognizing or perceiving the world in an aesthetic sense, what elements and colors and forms and sounds can be made and remade and brought together in such a way that something truly new, in the sense of, maybe a way, in a kind of ineffable way, where becoming, right, the sort of creative process itself feels present. There's a kind of spirituality, I think, with contemporary art that has retained an element, in the secular world of the spiritual, right? Of almost the religious imagination, the creation of the new. So we have to also become a bit like artists. William Irwin Thompson describes it as the bricolore, right? Similar idea, right? Of bringing different elements into relationship and seeing patterns and music amidst the noise of the present. And we have a lot of noise in our present right now. I think, you know, that's an understatement, and it's difficult work. We have to have the sensitivity of the artist as an integral featuring as a practice. We have to hone that sensitivity because there's a lot of noise today. So a lot of this is sort of attuning to these and these conditions and bringing these elements, agencies, movements, you know, social organizations, works of art, right? And cohering a kind of interrelationship between them. Maybe one last metaphor, you know, we can move from the ecological to the artistic and now maybe to the animistic, right? Is the medicine bundle, right? I think Ursula K. Le Guin has a great description of the medicine bundle, of the carrier bag, in her short little essay Theory of Fiction, where she describes or re-envisions the novel not as a kind of linear process where you move through a plot in a linear sense, but as a kind of bundle of interrelationships, right, that are in tension with each other, that are in synergy with each other, and everything in between. But it's the kind of whole bundling itself, right, the whole complex bundling itself that describes the novel, bringing things into transformative relationship in such a way that the reader is transformed, perhaps, and that the thing itself has a life of its own, right? So all of these things, I think, have to do with this sort of ecological way of thinking, right, of bringing things into relation, working with interrelationships and tensions and opposites, working with noise so as to attune to the music, you know, that's amidst that noise. And then maybe, you know, the last element too is you know, working with the ruins, right? Making a life and transforming catastrophe into possibility. And there's a lot of ways we can do that, I think, both personally and socially. And there's a lot of ways that we can say, like, well, okay, how do we imagine this sort of turning towards the integral future or integral mutation? What does it look like to have a civilization or a culture that has a different relationship with time? And those are other themes, but that gets sort of down other rabbit holes along the same direction, right? About, okay, well, what are some of the themes and where are the threads going? And, you know, how do we live more concretely and in the present? And, but it's a messy process. It's more about the process itself rather than kind of landing in some new reality. We're already in that reality here, right? If we can't do it here, we can't do it anywhere, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And it was funny because just you brought that up at the end, but I was just sat with this sense of, you know, that we need to experiment and, you know, maybe step outside of the pressure for things to immediately make sense or to immediately have a use to them. And, you know, to be in that kind of artistic sensibility or that ecological kind of arena where, you know, it's organic and it's messy and, you know, things emerge through these connections that you've articulated that they're unexpected, you know, and but there's a certain frequency to them, you know. And I think that's what I would love to have asked you about, you know, is, you know, so it's a beautiful invitation you're making. And you're already probably naming some of them, you know, artists out there, or, you know, maybe, I don't know if it's like ecological thinkers or, but people out there who you feel you're learning from, or you see they are kind of experimenting in this way. And, you know, there's a certain transmission through their work.
Yeah. To say briefly with that, yes. I mean, there's so many folks that I think are, again, in the sense of the title of the book, they're fragments of this integral futuring in so many of our, you know, overlapping communities, integral folks, metamodern folks. I really appreciate Nora Bateson's work with Warm Data Labs and just her writing and insights on this. I think, you know, she's very much articulating there's a lot of resonance with what I'm talking about and what I've been writing about and what I see in her work. So I think it's common in a certain sense, and which is wonderful. There's a sense that there's a strong mycelial web that's growing, and the earth is becoming very fecund. And a lot of this stuff is still very much sort of underneath the surface of culture. You know, there's this over culture, and then I think there's a lot of folks doing the work on the ground. There's different directions. I talk about it in the closing chapter of the book, but just sort of thematically, you know, this for me anyway, the integral mutation involves a kind of reversal, and I think part of the new relationship with time is being comfortable with reversal and not seeing reversal as regression, right? Moving and the enfolding of the past and the present and weaving it all together in novel ways. You know, this has to do with, you know, a general sense for many in the West, but I think outside of the Western context too, everybody who's had to deal with globalization and colonization and modernization, which is a sort of a shared challenge now, for better or worse, but the wrestling with, you know, our sense of belonging with the earth, with traditions, with histories and ancestors, there's an uprootedness, which is both the poison and the gift, right? That I think at a personal level, many, many, many people are working with. And, you know, this sort of move back towards reclaiming or re-envisioning tradition, right? At the same time, I think, you know, there's a lot of deep futuring work happening there. Maybe I can bring up like the Zapatista as another example, because I see in their articulations of their political project where they're mixing, you know, coming from a deep indigeneity, a rootedness with place, a deep sense of indigenous temporality in the sense of rhythmicity and let's say a temporality of place that's very much there, but they're also weaving in elements of modernity, you know, the sort of more radical and emancipatory aspirations of the modern project. And they're weaving in this, as they're even talking about in their own way, a new relationship with the future, which they see, you know, the moderns really kind of failing to do, the modern relationship with time failing to do. So I think there's a lot of interesting work happening there where this kind of zigzag movement, right, where the future becomes an element of the past and traditions are reimagined or roots are kind of re-envisioned, right, and transformed. And that's sort of a general cultural sense that I think might apply to many different projects and contexts and communities. But, you know, at an artistic level, I spent a good amount of time in one of the essays on reclaiming time and integral futuring, on the work of Daniel Lopatin, or Oniotrix Point, OPN, who maybe not every individual would appreciate the kind of electronic music aesthetically. But
you said
me,
that name
just,
again, it just cut out the
oh,
musician.
Oh, sorry, yes. Daniel Lopatin, or Oniotrix Point Never, OPN, just by shorthand. I write about him at length because his own kind of thinking about his artistic process is very much kind of what I'm describing here, right? This sort of exploding the present and the elements of the present, seeking, you know, seeing the debris and the ruin, like commercials from the 1990s, nostalgia, right? This yearning for the past, which is an intense cultural phenomenon in the past decade, past 15 years or so. He's working with this kind of yearning for the past, working and sifting through the debris, the media debris of digital culture and analog, and putting them together in such a way that the future begins. There's a futuring sound that kind of opens up in his creative expression that I feel is very much there. So I see him kind of doing this interesting zigzag, right? Where again, the future has to do with the past. You know, again, to kind of touch back on this, not just the Zapatista, but my own Mexican heritage. I talk about this in the writing, and maybe I've mentioned it before, but part of the creation myth for the Aztecs, is that the gods, before they created the first people, they had to go down into the underworld where they gathered up the bones of the ancestors who were already there somehow and brought them back up to the surface and use those bones to create the first people. So there's this idea of going down, or reversal, or going to the roots, right? Drawing up an ever-present past, right? Using that past to transform it, to transform the bones of the ancestors into the bodies of the future, bodies of people, right? So there's a sense of this movement of reversal is sort of the nature of transformation. So we have to become comfortable with perceiving time, elements of time. I'm using artistic elements here. Let's just say sampling, you know, audio tracks from the past and bygone eras, and mixing them with the present. And in that mixture and intermixture, the future starts to sort of leak through or shine through in a way. So that's the kind of the signature I look for anyway in artistic expression. And OPN is one example, right? I think there's many different kind of little micro examples happening all over the place. And some great writing kind of getting into that sort of the work of nostalgia artists, right, that are doing more than nostalgia, doing something much more interesting where they're bringing the past back, but in doing so, they're not just looking backward. They're working with time in a different way. They have a different, fundamentally different relationship with time, which is sort of taking root in us. And I think it's, we're already mutants again in that sense, right? That digital artists are playing with time as if it was a kind of medium that was plastic and malleable, right? Or ecological in the sense of weaving different elements of past and present. That mixing again, the future starts to show up.
Do you think one could do that? Because these are really great examples, and you know, of people taking things from culture and bringing it into the present. And wondering whether, you know, individually that process might also be taking place on some level, you know, in a sense, like, you know, I think of Cynthia Bergeau, and I might be actually kind of getting into the weeds here, but this kind of, and I've forgotten the phrase that she uses now, actually, when she talks about imaginal perception. There's a kind of like spherical kind of perception of how events all fit together from the past and the future. And I'm just wondering how, you know, in our own lives, if we might kind of tune into, I've been thinking about my past and certain events recently, and it's almost as if they break forth, memories break forth into my awareness in ways that, you know, almost, yeah, they connect me to the sense of who I'm becoming, you know, as if there's unlocking some sense of being called into the future. So there's a kind of spherical, not a linear process, you know. It has a kind of alchemical feel to it, and a kind of felt sense of luminosity or revelation to it, a freshness kind of breaking through. So I'm just kind of speaking now, actually, this is just coming to me through our conversation, but there's a kind of, it's funnily enough, almost like an artistry to it. I found myself becoming interested in almost like a kind of cross-paradigmatic, cross-disciplinary sensibility, whereby many different aesthetic elements suddenly take on new meaning and become fuel for continuing evolution. I don't know if this makes sense, but
yeah, you're speaking music to my ears here. Beautifully spoken, Joel. Yeah, I think in the most personal of ways, this is a practice that we can implement, you know, in our most intimate inner work, right? I think maybe one example I could share as well, right? I was doing some journaling work, and you know, I go back and forth between analog and digital. But the nice thing about for me anyway, for the analog work, right, is that I cracked open a notebook that I had started 3 years ago or so. And there was just something about the synchrony of the timing, the subject matter that was present in this notebook on the sort of the last few pages I had been working on it and had left it, was very much kind of present in that day, just sort of by happenstance. I had been mulling it over again. And I had this sort of very interesting moment of feeling myself kind of fold time, right? The past really coming forward into the present in a way where, you know, it felt not just like coincidence, and maybe not just synchronicity either, but a sense of living relationship, right? Like there was a relation here. And this is why I go to images of the rhizome and the root. And you mentioned Cynthia Bourgeau. I think she calls it imaginal time. It's that sense of interrelationship, right? A true living interrelationship in a personal way with our own memory and history, particularly important or significant moments, or even ones that don't seem significant until later on, right? And then we kind of see, we have a sense of being through and making those connections in, you know, later on years ahead, you know, years forward, we look back and we start to kind of see how these threads were interweaving as if they were, again, like a root system kind of growing underneath us and only coming to the surface later in a sense of latency. So I think for us, you know, there's a personal sense that time is a sort of integrative or transparent interrelationship, right? There's living connections between past and future for our own sort of personal growth and transformation, and also for our own kind of, maybe to bring in more of a Jungian sense, there's a sort of circumnavigating of the self, right? As we turn and return to particular themes that show up in our life, right? And we start to see the relationship between these moments as something that's significant. And we benefit from this work of making those connections. You know, there's a shining through of the self that sort of emerges or appears between these particular moments of insight and of experience that give us a wider glimpse of what it means to be a self, right? To be a person, right? Perhaps a glimpse of the soul. I'm thinking, like, of course, of like Proust, right? And his interest in memory. Gebser also really loved Proust, and it speaks very highly of his work, right? Where he's not just about memory, but he's working with memory, right? We've been talking about here, like there's a sense of working with the past to become the future, right? But Proust worked with memory, and that became his sort of means for achieving this open relational time. There's a lot of interesting lines that Gebser quotes from Proust, you know, talking about how he describes it, that life is sort of always forging and gathering itself into these thicker and denser webs of interconnection, right? And that his work is sort of maybe an extension of that, right? His work on nostalgia or memory, right? Proust's Madeleine, a very sensorial experience that sort of explodes into the present, a memory from his childhood sort of erupting into the present. That's the kind of work I think that we can do at a personal level, right? So journaling, I think, is a great way to do that. But I think even just sort of affirming this, right, as a, you know, time as a relational, time has relational quality, where those living interrelationships can be worked with and reworked with and are meant to be, you know, they're not just sort of static and you're not just kind of finding a scaffolding underneath the surface of your consciousness. There's an active turning and returning and re-relating in ways where new connections are forged, but then also there's a sense of re-envisioning the past, right? Remembering the past in new ways and helping us transform, right, our relationship with that history, transforming that history itself, because it's still here, it's still alive with us, right? So there's a sense of a creative relationship with time, whether it's past or future, and it's very much something that we can do in our own lives as a sort of practice of integral futuring.
Could you say something about weird time as well? Because that's interesting that, like, I found myself saying to someone recently, and this is funny because I went to art school, and this is where I heard this phrase. It was this guy, and he said, "When the going gets weird, the weird get going." And it just always stayed with me. It's like, yeah, that's how I feel. And he wasn't like talking about silly, like being goofy or silly, although that could be part of being weird, I guess. But it was like, that when things kind of break, things kind of alter and disrupt, it kind of evokes a certain mode of being, which can kind of align with that, can kind of tap into it, and there's a generative potential, rather than being kind of weirded out and like trying to get back to some sanitized place. And I don't know when I hadn't read about where you talked about what weird time was to you, so might mean something very different to what I'm pointing to.
Yeah, I mean, I love weirding as a term has been really kind of taking off, maybe in no small part to my friends over at the Weird Studies podcast, JF Martel and Phil Ford. But a weird time for me, I refer to it in my writing at least as maybe some of the best, more contemporary examples, other than the climate crisis, which continues to be weird, in the sense that there's a subversion of expectations. There's a disruption of normative patterns, right? What temperature spring is going to be, how much rain we're going to receive in one season or another. That there's a subversion in that sense. All that's kind of getting disrupted, and then of course there's this, shared sense of, again, the past and the future kind of leaning heavily into the present. Andreas Malm's line that, that now more than ever, we're inhabiting a kind of temporal structure of feeling, where everything's being drawn into the whole of time, right? And that, the air is heavy with time. There's all weird stuff. But another element might be like the recent pandemic. During lockdown and everything else, I found a lot of people describing a kind of weird time where the structure of productivity was completely upended. And not only were folks staying at home, but there was also the sense of blurring of clock time, right? I think there was a Guardian article where one author was describing that we don't live in clock time anymore. We live in a time soup, right? Where the days begin to blur and folks began to sort of notice, plants growing in their windowsills or lunar cycles, right? Because everyone was sort of stuck and forced to slow down a little bit. So there's this weirding of clock time that I think continues to be in multiple facets, either a daily occurrence or an annual occurrence, where that structure, predictable abstract structure of time, and our schedule continues to be subverted. But I think there's a power in this too, right? As you're saying, there's a transformative element in this, in the sense that, something Bergson talks about, there's a quality to subversion or disruption or weirding, where we hesitate for a moment. And in that moment of hesitation, the world is able to reveal itself to us anew, right? Aspect of the world reveals itself, a different aspect of objects or phenomena reveal themselves to us with a new face. And we need that occasionally, just as sort of living through the world, that the new can only really show up when we don't force the world to be, as Heidegger describes, ready at hand for us as a tool, like turning on a light switch, right? When something doesn't behave as it predictably should, when clock time doesn't tick mechanically as we were expecting it to, therein lies the possibility for the future, right? Therein lies the opening of time, because now the new is present. Now something can become, right? And everything has kind of cleared the way for a different relationship, a different kind of possibility to be present. So hesitation for me, you know, again, to borrow from Bergson, is this very much a kind of becoming present with the world. Gebser calls it presentiating, right? The present really kind of becoming conscious, right? The only way we can really do that is to really see the world in a truly creative sense, which is the world is full of possibility and contingency, but it's also full of metamorphosis, right? And it's really in these moments where our expectations, our rationalizations, our sort of cultural overcoding of the world is disrupted. And I think civilization-wide, we're kind of undergoing that right now, where Gaia is no longer behaving according to expectations, and nor our control, right? So maybe that speaks to what you're talking about with weirding, right? Weirding and hesitation, I think they kind of go hand in hand here, where I would call it, Gebser calls it the plenum, right? But there's a sense of overflow of meaning and possibility in the present and the forms in the present, including ourselves, that reveals itself for maybe a fleeting moment. But in that moment, you know, that changes us forever. That might transform an entire culture, let alone an individual. It brings forth possibility.
I mean, in a sense, like, this conversation is an invitation, I think, into, you know, a certain mode of being. And I'm thinking of, again, how I mentioned, you know, the kind of unfolding presence-based approaches in coaching and transformational work, which, you know, step away from, like, this notion of improvement and success. And I think they're more in this realm of unfoldment. So by letting go of our somewhat more egoic need to control where things go and spatialize, you know, in the way you've described earlier, spatialize our development as if we can corral it, you know, to kind of down some kind of like track that we've predetermined. And instead, you know, there's kind of letting go and letting and kind of opening with as presence to this moment, to how life wants to unfold through us, you know. And it's a kind of felt sense as a vibrational quality and aliveness that we tune into. And it's, you know, sometimes unexpected and unbidden, and you know, to kind of, it's actually about relationship. It's about attuning to what wants to connect. And so this is a practice I've found to be very, I don't know, life-giving and enjoyable. And, you know, connects to when I was making art and when I was DJing, there's a similar sensibility. Are there, you know, practices? You've actually mentioned journaling, and there's, you know, you've alluded to many artists and practices in a sense, but I'm just wondering if there are others that you think are ways to open into this, to what wants to come through.
Gosh, yeah, I think I'm thinking of a individual who we both know, Spring Cheng's work is great in this sense, right? The along similar lines, right? Doing this work of you know, working with the tensions, the irresolvable tensions. I think this is a work that all of us can wrestle with in different ways, but those tensions of the secular world, this sense of, you know, growth and improvement and development not being a linear process, right? That sometimes, again, to sort of reiterate, going to become, to transform means to also go back, right? In the Ursula K. Le Guin refers to, in one of her essays, the porcupine from the Cree Nation, where porcupine kind of moves backwards and forwards. They step back to look forward into a crevice to kind of move towards the future. So there's a sense of negotiating the many layers of self, right? The self of tradition and the self of traditional roots with the self of modernity. And, you know, if our expectation is that we're kind of a predictable stadial trajectory for our becoming, I think that that definitely needs to be subverted. We need different, this is something Spring and I have been in conversation with about recently, right? We need sort of different images of what it means to become, you know, to be a human being, I think is always, you know, sort of walking this path of the zigzag and the spiral, right? Where we return and return to element who we were before, which in some sense might, you know, the future might look like bringing those elements forward and re-enlivening them from new perspectives and regenerating them or re-engaging them in new ways. It doesn't necessarily mean marching ahead, right? It might also mean kind of growing down, right? Or bringing the roots up to offer new sporulations or new fruit, right? So how do we move becoming as this weaving of past and present, right? I think I'm kind of coming back around to that same sort of theme, right? That when we talk about development or adult development or personal development, I think our modelings can sometimes obscure the actual dynamic process, that the shape of time is something much more complex and interrelated. And for me, anyway, this is another subject to talk their time, right? But to me, that this sort of brings forward this sort of necessary project of, you know, for those who are doing this kind of work, can we have different models, right? You know, maybe it's not sufficient to say the map is not the territory in that sense, but to transform the map, right? So that the map is faithful, right, to the phenomena that it saves the appearances, right, of ourselves in the world and reflects those shapes of time, right? Those it's between past and future in our own becoming. So I think, you know, again, in our own kind of personal interrogation here, right? The sense that the way we move through time, and it doesn't necessarily mean we have to throw away, you know, the possibility of, you know, I want to transform, I want to heal, I want to, there's a sense of becoming something greater. There's a sense of transcendence or the transcendental that's not necessarily something but our relationship with it might need to be more process oriented and open-ended, and the maps and the models themselves might need to reflect that as well. I keep coming back to the Zapatista because they ended up kind of unexpectedly kind of shining through in my research at the end of the book, and they have this one more excellent kind of example for them is like, well, how do we, you know, what does this futuring look like? But I think this applies sort of personally for us in terms of development and personal development, right? You know, we go towards planetary futures, not by an advance forward, but simply by walking, right? And they use the example of walking because they say, you know, that the path doesn't follow a straight or predetermined line when you're walking in relationship with place, you know, over a particular topology or mountain or river, you know, alongside a river. It's winding, right? Like walking, right? The path is never going to follow the linear, but it's going to move with the landscape, right? It's going to go backwards and forwards or up and down, right? And it's made out of many kind of questions and doubts. And, you know, each of those kind of inquiries have to show up with each step, right? It's not laid out before us, but it does arise with us moving through the process, right? It's something we're in relationship with, again, the future. Even as a sort of if it's an anticipatory desire for transformation, is something we have to be in process and in and it's found through communicating with that process in dialogue, right? Remaining in the sort of ecological middle with it. So we don't know what it's going to look like, but we can compose with it. We can compose the shape of it as we move through it, right? And with it. So I suppose maybe that's my emerging answer to this question of like, how do we kind of re-envision these models? I think we need more process-oriented ways of thinking about our own becoming while saving the sense of anticipatory desire, right? This sense of moving towards what we may become, but it's a becoming with, right? And we have to kind of walk it step by step in this deeper undulating process. Hopefully that'll make sense.
Yeah. It's like, for me, the sense of desire and longing I have that I can project on a future, and that's fine. But it's a place to live from, almost like it's this sensibility. And I as I hear you speak, it's like I hear, you know, again, I just think of how in some places, or let me say this, it's like, and in my own life, there's often this sense of, my, you know, even in inverted commas, my coaching, my development, personal development work should always trend towards more clarity, more knowing, you know, being clear on the path, taking the next step, knowing exactly where I'm going, getting more, becoming better. And actually, how when you look back, that you just see how non-linear the whole process is, and how there's a big mystery to it, and how you know, the things come forth unbidden and unexpectedly, and sometimes rapidly and other times not, and that's beautiful. So I hear when you talk about the Zapatista, that's what I'm kind of tuning into. So yeah, I don't know if there's anything else you want to name in our conversation, Jeremy, that we haven't spoken about as we come towards the end of our time. And I'd love to also invite you to share where people can find out more about what you're up to. But yeah, is there anything that feels important to speak into that we haven't named yet?
Well, thanks, Joel. I always enjoy our conversations, and this one is no different. I appreciate the kind of deepening into the questions together, right? I feel a sense of walking with you in these inquiries. But I suppose the only other element here for me is just emphasize here as you're just describing, you know, I think the line along the Zapatista description of this is the process itself is what gives the path its direction, right? So there's a sense of really kind of being present with our own becoming as process, that we learn what shape, you know, actually is emerging there. It's not predetermined, right? So as you're describing it, it's sort of a calling into a sort of deeper becoming with, right? To find out what that future particularly might be. And while at the same time, you know, being quite encouraging and inviting to feel into that sense of anticipatory desire, this desire to become, to transform. That is also the future, you know, living in the present. That is also living the future in the present in that sense, to work with that desire within process, to learn its shape, to learn its directions. So yeah, just that. And then, you know, I think for folks who want to connect, you know, I have a course coming up, very short, sort of weekend three-parter, where it's drawing a lot from the latter half of the manuscript on integral futuring. It's called Integral Futuring, Reclaiming Time in the Radical Present. And folks can probably just find it going to mute. blog or my Substack, and of course the latest podcast kind of goes into it a little bit as well. So that's coming up on December 5th. It's 3 days, and we're kind of having a two-parter each day, where there's a sort of an opening presentation discussion and then a closing presentation. We sort of repeat that for 3 days, a little weekend intensive. And then, you know, I guess stay tuned for the manuscript itself. I'm going to be publishing excerpts from it, but I'm hoping to have the book out in the new year, early new year, maybe February or so. We'll see if all goes well. It should be available, hopefully in the new year, maybe January, February for pre-sale. But yeah, those are good places to plug in. Thanks for letting me share that a little bit.
Beautiful. Thanks for joining me again, Jeremy. And look forward to seeing the book come out. And thank you just for, just love being in dialogue with you. So thanks.
Likewise, Joel. Yeah, thanks for this wonderful conversation. Until next time, whenever that is, ever presently.
Thanks for tuning into the podcast. I really hope you enjoyed it. And a reminder that the early bird enrollment is now open for our upcoming live training with Jim Dethmer and Bob Anderson. It's called Unlocking Leaders, and it's going to teach you how to coach at the level of consciousness, which is, for me, the highest leverage move you can make as a coach. Your client's consciousness is the place where the deepest, truest transformational breakthroughs come from. And often traditional coaching misses this, and it's something that our clients need us to learn as coaches, because our times are calling for something deeper. We've got to go beneath the content of our experience, beneath strategy, to the source of change. And that's exactly what Unlocking Leaders is designed to teach you. I'm so proud of this program, of what it's become. I feel it's our offering in these times. And if you're ready to answer the call of these times, then you can join the full program. So just head to coachesrising.com/leaders to book your spot. And remember, you can get the early bird discount if you join by 29th of May. Here we are. We're at the end of the podcast. Just a heads up again, if you're not on our mailing list and you want to stay in the loop about other things we create, then head to coachesrising.com, put your name in the sign-up box there. You'll also find some of our other offerings, our online trainings for coaches there. And just want to end by wishing you well, and I'll see you again next time.